even further than they already were. And I hate to make it sound like it wouldn't be released on the journey, because that's how we would get radioactivity in us. It's through release. But this would be caused by an accident. And yes, it would be a complete failure on the last train derailment, the train derailment before that. There was a fire in the tunnel recently. Everything that has happened when compared to what we would be carrying would have proven damage to the containment. But back to the issue, even if Yucca opened, even if it opened, which it never should, it would only be able to hold a part of the total amount of waste that they would be shipping there anyway. So it couldn't even hold what is in place for, do you know what I mean? You can't take all of these trains and trucks and risk all of this damage and disaster and then get them to Yucca, where it can't even receive half of this shipment. And yet that is the plan.
Again, speaking with Mimi Gurman of radcast.org and No Nukes Northwest. Mimi, any closing thoughts, and where can people learn more about all this?
Well, I will have things posted on No Nukes Northwest about this and the campaign, and we'll keep people posted as to what they can do. And you can always get in touch with me at info@radcast.org to answer questions. If anybody out there feels like purchasing a Geiger counter, I can help get you set up with that. We always need more people to measure radiation in our area and let us know what's going on, so we can post that too.
Well, terrific. Mimi, thank you so much. Again, I've been speaking with Mimi Gurman of radcast.org and No Nukes Northwest. Mimi, thank you. This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Dia de los Muertos Celebration at Audio Cinema in Portland on November 1st from 1 p.m. to midnight. This is a celebration of life, honoring loved ones that have passed on via food, live musical performance, live dance performance, sugar skull decorating, children's storytelling, and much more. Again, that's Dia de los Muertos Celebration at Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Street in Portland, on November 1st from 1 p.m. to midnight. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio, along with the International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee and the Jericho Movement, is a proud co-sponsor of Decolonization and Political Prisoners, Thursday, October 29th from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. at the Portland State University Native American Community Center. The evening will focus on U.S.-held political prisoners and decolonizing the prison-industrial complex. Speakers include Chauncey Peltier, son of Leonard Peltier, Kent Ford, founder of Portland Black Panther Party, and father of Patrice Lumumba Ford, and Ajamu Umi of the Portland chapter of the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Again, that's Decolonization and Political Prisoners, Thursday, October 29th from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. at the Portland State University Native American Community Center, located at 710 Southwest Jackson Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 6:03 and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 Community Radio. At 6 is coming up next is Labor Radio, followed by Prison Pipeline at 6:30, and at 7, Hard Knock Radio. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Revolution Hall, presenting Southern blues rocker and ZZ Top guitarist Billy Gibbons and the BFG's Perfectamundo Tour. Billy Gibbons performs Friday, December 11th, and tickets and information for this 21 and over performance are available at revolutionhallpdx.com.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. to you waiting for lunch break as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up. It's Labor Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to Labor Radio. Your host for tonight is me, John Walsh. We're going to talk about something that's a big deal for lots of us in labor, which is two-tier wages. Most prominent recently in the negotiations for new contracts in the automobile industry. Joining us live on the telephone from Michigan is Martha Gravatt, who's a Chrysler worker, auto worker at Chrysler, also a rank-and-file activist in the union. Welcome to Labor Radio, Martha.
Thanks for having me.
Martha, the auto workers at Chrysler voted down the first contract offer that was presented to them by the union's leadership. That was in September, and then last week ratified the second one. What were the big reasons for voting no the first time, and what changed that got a yes vote in the second go-around?
Well, there's growing sentiment on the shop floor that the two-tier pay system must go. This was introduced in 2007, and while no current worker at that time had to take a pay cut, it imposed drastic reductions in pay for future workers. So that there would be, at that time, a difference of roughly $12 an hour between the first tier and the second tier once they reached the top of the pay scale. In 2009, there were more concessions during the bankruptcy, and the pay for second-tier workers was frozen at $14.50. In 2011, this rate was raised to a maximum of $19.28, but that still left a huge gap of almost $9 an hour. So you have people working together side by side, making vastly unequal rates of pay. And it was very divisive, it was very unfair, and we all knew it. So when we were asked to vote yes on a contract that kept the tiers in place, while it did narrow the gap, it in no way eliminated the gap. So that was one of several reasons why we flat out rejected the contract the first time. And many of us did still object to the second version of the contract because it did not eliminate two-tier. What the contract did, though, it gave most second-tier workers a progression where they would eventually be making the same hourly wage as their higher seniority sisters and brothers. So there was a lot of feeling of accomplishment around that, where we had been told that couldn't happen, that these first-tier wages were going to be a thing of the past, and we won the right for our sisters and brothers to eventually make the same pay.
How long does that progression take for the people in the lower tier?
I think it's a ridiculously long amount of time. It takes 8 years for someone to, from the date of hire to the date that they are making the maximum hourly pay rate for their classification. When you consider that it takes someone in skilled trades only 4 years to complete an apprenticeship and get to top pay, when you consider that the trades jobs are supposedly more skilled and that's why they pay more, it seems rather extreme to expect someone to wait 8 years to get to the top pay for a job that is considered to be less skilled. But even with the eight-year progression, there are thousands of workers who have 4, 5, and 6 years seniority already, so they will be getting to the top of the pay scale during the contract. So that's a really big deal for them.
How long is this contract going to last?
It's a four-year contract.
Okay, so somebody's already got 4 years or more, will get to the top of scale during the life of the contract. The other people are going to have to hope things go well in the next contract too, right?
Yeah, that's the problem, because there's no guarantee for the younger seniority workers who will not reach the top by the end of the contract that this language will be carried over for another 4 years. There could be a downturn in the industry, and the company could cry poverty, and we could end up with the wages frozen again, as they were frozen in 2009. Originally, they were supposed to be frozen at $14.50 an hour until this year.
And people might not realize something you just described a little while ago, that two-tier actually started before the bankruptcy. It wasn't something that first came into effect during bankruptcy. It already had happened.
Well, you know, it's not new to the labor movement, unfortunately. We began to see two-tier and union contracts in the early 80s in the airline industry around the time of the break-in of the PATCO strike, and they started appearing in the retail industry, and over time spread to other parts of the labor movement. The first major two-tier contract involving the UAW was after the Caterpillar strike was broken. The first auto industry contracts that had that scourge were in the spin-offs from General Motors and Ford, namely Delphi, American Axle, or GM spin-offs, and Visteon was a spin-off of part of the Ford Parts division. And when those companies were first spun off, they had identical contracts to GM and Ford, and they were told, oh, it's no big deal. It's a new company, but it's, you know, you'll get the same wages and benefits. But then, you know, in the next contract, they brought in two-tier, and then in 2007, they brought it to us at Ford, GM, and Chrysler, and there was a slump in the auto industry. Profits were down, and for whatever reason, the union negotiators made a decision to allow the companies to have a lower pay scale for future workers rather than try to convince the current members that they should take a pay cut.
Now, among the big three, there's very different rate of the use of two-tier, isn't there? Isn't Chrysler by far the one that has the largest number of two, or percentage at least, of two-tier workers?
Yes, Chrysler by far has the largest number since emerging from bankruptcy. They've seen the biggest surge in sales and market share. They eliminated a lot of workers during the bankruptcy. A number of plants were closed, including a plant in Ohio that I worked at for 23 years, and many workers could not relocate, and other workers were just feeling like they wouldn't have a future with Chrysler, that it really wasn't going to survive that long. So they took buyouts and left the company, and these were all higher-paid workers. There hadn't been any second-tier workers hired yet at that time. So the company was able to shake the tree and shed a lot of higher-paid workers. And then when sales started going through the roof again, they were able to hire a large percentage of lower-paid workers. And they've been profiting from this. It's really a higher rate of exploitation.
Now let's talk about the organizing that went into the no vote on the first contract. As I understand it, that contract came with a favorable recommendation from the leadership that bargained it and was presented to the membership, and the membership resoundingly said no. So what happened on shop floors and in locals, and what sort of activism and organization went into that big vote no?
There was a real grassroots movement, and a lot of people who never really been activists before became organizers and activists and put rallies together. There was an informational meeting in Toledo, and some of the workers organized a rally outside. They had signs saying, "Hell no, Sergio," which is a reference to CEO of Fiat Chrysler, Sergio Marchionne, and equal pay for equal work, different signs. There were workers at the Jefferson North assembly plant in Detroit that went down to picket the UAW international headquarters, you know, to complain that they were not bargaining the kind of contract that we wanted. different plants. Workers made T-shirts. There was a parts warehouse in L.A. where they made T-shirts that said "Solidarity, No More Tears, Vote No." I worked with a rank-and-file group called Auto Worker Caravan, and we had a leaflet called "The Contract Lowlights," and we got that out all over, really all over the country, to the different plants. So there was a lot of people that felt strongly, that had a lot of one-on-one conversations with people. So there were all kinds of organizing efforts going on.
And it seems like not only did that succeed in getting the no vote necessary to reject the first contract, but it also succeeded in spelling out what members wanted, at least sufficiently to change the terms in the second contract regarding two-tier to something that was significantly better than the original.
Yes, I think some of the concerns were made clear in addition to improving on the wage formula. There was a very unpopular attendance procedure, and that procedure was liberalized. There was a health care co-op that was going to be introduced, and there were a lot of unanswered questions. Workers were nervous about it. They dropped the health care co-op. So some of the concerns were addressed, but there's other ways that new tiers have been introduced in this new contract. In fact, there are more tiers in this one than in the previous one. So they're kind of circumventing the issues that they addressed only partially.
What are those new tiers? What happened now that was different from before?
Well, there's still a lower rate of pay for future new hires. So it's like we're committing the same sin of 2007 all over again. And before, they had temporary part-time workers who covered on the weekends and the days of high absenteeism. And they eventually made the same hourly rate as a full-time second-tier worker. But under this contract, temporary workers, they're no longer part-time. They work Monday through Friday and weekends when needed, but they're maximum hourly rate is almost $8 an hour lower than the hourly rate for a permanent worker. And then there's an even lower rate for future temporary workers. There's also an axle plant in Marysville, Michigan, about an hour north of Detroit. And that plant, a lower rate of pay, almost, you know, roughly $10 an hour lower, was negotiated for workers at that plant. So there's like little ways that were collectively being nickeled and dimed by the company to offset the added costs of equalizing the pay for a big chunk of the workers.
So the future new hires are going to start even lower. Where do they wind up at top of scale for them?
Well, there's three groups. There's several groups of future new hires. The workers in the plants, they have a four-year progression. They start at 17, which is where the current second-tier workers are getting a raise to 17. But then there's a four-year progression to 22.50, and then the contract doesn't show any additional pay increases. They also have a parts warehouse. The parts distribution centers are in the division known as Mopar, and one of the controversies in the first contract, in addition to keep every second-tier worker at a lower pay rate, they had a rate for Mopar that was a couple dollars lower than for the workers in the plants. Well, they eliminated that for current Mopar workers, but the future Mopar workers, they have an $8 progression, but their top pay is about $5 an hour less than the plant workers now. And it's, you know, almost $5 an hour less than current Mopar workers. So, and then there's the lower rate for current temporary workers of $22 an hour, but future temporary workers is only just over $19 an hour. So there's so many different rates of pay. And then even workers that make the same hourly rate now, the highest hourly rate, the benefits are unequal. The workers hired after, under the 2007 contract and later, they don't get the same health insurance, and they don't have a defined benefit pension, and they don't get health insurance when they retire. There's other discrepancies. So it's just, there's just all these multiple gradations of compensation now for workers doing essentially the same work.
So it sounds like there's plenty yet to be accomplished in the next go-around when it's time to bargain the successor contract to this one.
Well, there's plenty to fight for even before then, because another big issue that drove the no vote that really hasn't really been addressed, although, you know, it may appear to be, and that's the issue of job security. And in the promotional materials for the second contract, there's a lot of emphasis on a $5.3 billion investment plan with the promise that when there's investments, that secures jobs. But I think if you know anything about, you know, technology and robotics and how it's changed the auto industry, we know that every time there's a big investment, it's to bring in the latest technology to make more products faster and with fewer workers. And there's a whole game of musical chairs going around where the car production, the Dodge Dart and the Chrysler 200 apparently are leaving the UAW family of plants. And we're told it's not guaranteed that the work is going to Mexico, but when I said, well, where else would it go, I didn't get an answer. So we're just going to be building trucks and SUVs mainly in the UAW assembly plants that we have left, and they're moving all the truck production around, and this vehicle's going here and another one's going there. The Warren Truck plant, which is next door to my plant, I work in a stamping plant, could lose 2,400 out of 3,600 jobs when the Ram truck is moved to a neighboring plant in Sterling Heights, Michigan. But that plant, according to even the rosy projections of the company and the union leadership, is only going to gain like 1,750 jobs. So that's a net loss of jobs in Metro Detroit. And that's without a downturn, and there could be a downturn. And, you know, what if the price of gas goes up again and people stop buying these gas guzzlers? And it's also an environmentally irresponsible business plan. So we can start, you know, fighting to make sure that we keep our jobs, we can oppose the layoffs that are coming. And so we've got, I think we've got a big fight right now. And of course, you know, even the best contract is signed on a Monday, and by Tuesday, the company's trying to violate every provision, and you've got to backload of grievances before you know it. So,
got enforce,
you know, there's
it.
Always a fight between the two sides in the glass barricades.
Right, got to enforce the contract, and certainly where the jobs are and what products are getting made is going to be a big issue going forward. And with free trade agreements becoming more and more prevalent, and it becoming easier and easier for profits to cross borders while people cannot, that's just going to get worse, I think, for everybody in all countries.
It's not just Chrysler, but Ford and GM, you know, they tried to justify two-tier by saying that it was going to make it possible to produce small cars, even subcompact cars, in the United States again, that supposedly they don't make enough profit on these cars, the poor companies, so they need to have a lower pay scale. And the General Motors Lake Orion plant was actually the model of their fewer and cheaper workers formula. This plant was closed during bankruptcy and then reopened to produce the Chevy Sonic and the Buick Verano with much fanfare. But the intent of General Motors, which CUAW did not oppose, was to make this plant eventually 100% second-tier workforce. Well, that plant just laid off an entire shift of production, and there's talk that that work is actually going to be going to Mexico, along with probably the Dodge Dart and the Chrysler 200. Also, Ford is moving production of the Ford Focus back to Mexico because I guess, you know, our low wages aren't low enough. But they use the argument to make two tiers somehow more appetizing by saying it would help bring jobs back to the country. And now they've gotten the lower wage scale and the lower benefit scale. But now it's across the board, and they're paying lower wages to workers that are not building small, low-profit margin vehicles, but are building the most profitable members of the corporate vehicle fleet.
Speaking of the other automakers in the Big Three, last night there was word there's a tentative agreement now between the UAW and General Motors. Is it too soon to know anything about what that contains?
The word is that it will somewhat follow the Fiat Chrysler pattern with some deviation, but so far no details have been leaked.
Okay, we'll stay tuned for that. Martha, I want to thank you very much for sharing with us what's going on with auto workers these days and the fight to win a better contract, to send the leadership back to the table and do better than they did the first time. And hopefully that's a model for many of us. Keep up the good work and the good fight, and we'll be looking forward to talking to you again in the future.
Okay, yeah, thanks for thinking about us.
Okay, good night, Martha.
Keep the fight. Good night.
Here in Oregon, we had a similar issue where there's a campaign to raise the minimum wage, and leadership has one idea about how high to raise it, and members and rank and filers have a different idea. Our co-host and brother Jamie Partridge was at the Oregon AFL-CIO convention this weekend and brought back some audio, people talking about that issue of how high the minimum wage should go. Let's take a listen to that.
This is Jamie Partridge with Labor Radio. I'm here talking with Amanda Hill of the Oregon Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals, who's works at Kaiser, and she was at the mic at the Oregon AFL-CIO convention in favor of the $15 minimum wage initiative. Amanda, tell us why you support the $15 minimum wage initiative.
I have a daughter in college who's going to have to pay back a lot of student loans, and if she doesn't make at least $15 an hour, she's not going to be able to do that. I'm not ready for her to come back home and live with me.
Tell us what you said at the microphone.
Well, basically, I said that, using the calculator, the family budget calculator that the Economic Policy Institute put out, in order for us to survive on $13.50, we're either going to have to move to Oklahoma, Tennessee, Minnesota, or Nebraska, because in the state of Oregon, you need at least $14.18. So, raising the wage to $15 would at least give us the chance to save for our retirement, help fund college, and prepare for any emergency that might show up.
All right. Thank you, Amanda Hill. And I've got Tina Turner-Morfitt here with me from AFSCME, Council 75 and the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. Tina, you spoke at the mic in support of the $15 minimum wage ballot initiative. Tell us about what you said.
Well, basically what I said right now, while the unions are out trying to coalesce with the communities, trying to convince community people that unions are for them, what I said to the delegates today is that we have to be true to that. We can't go and bargain a $15 minimum wage for our members, but then do something less for the community who are non-union workers. If we want to win folks over, we have to do it in good deeds, and a good deed is to fight for a minimum wage of $15. We can't have it both ways.
So there was quite a bit of debate here about the difference between the $13.50 ballot initiative and the $15 ballot initiative. How do you feel about the outcome of the vote here?
Well, you know, I'm really encouraged by the vote, but again, a lot will depend on what happens from this point forward. We have some very dedicated individuals out there who are grass union workers, and they are out there really trying to move this issue, and that's the only reason the issue is still alive. And so I think if we have our sister unions get out there and start supporting them by giving them funds, by encouraging our members to get out there in front of 15 now, then I think we'll demonstrate to the public that we're not just talking out of both sides of our mouth. I mean, they see what's happening on TV. They see when we're able to negotiate a $15 minimum wage for union workers who are already represented. But if they hear us, if we go out there and we fight for something less, like $13.50 for them, then they're going to say, why aren't I good enough?
Thank you very much, Tina Turner-Morford of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists.
That was Jamie Partridge with an update on the fight for 15 here in Oregon. Thanks to Jamie, my co-host. Thanks to Daniel Parks, the engineer for Labor Radio. This is John Walsh saying thanks for listening and good night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Halloween Community Rally and the Spirit of Unity on Saturday, October 31st at Waterfront Park in Portland. In the Spirit of Unity will be a family-friendly rally to raise the minimum wage, defend workers' rights, demand renters' rights, and support immigrants' rights. There will be trick-or-treating, costume contests, games, prizes, and music by Portland hip-hop artists. Again, that's In the Spirit of Unity, a Halloween community rally on Saturday, October 31st.